Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening and welcome to another episode of Swords in Space Radio. I'm one of your hosts, Nicholas Wansbutter, joined with Stephen Heiner, and glad to have you back with us, Stephen. And tonight we're going to be talking about the Hobbit film, or at least the first part of three that was released right around this past Christmas time. And we're joined once again by Matthew Zepp, former seminarian, high school teacher, and most importantly, science fiction writer and reader and editor-in-chief of Brav's Index. So thanks for joining us again, Matthew.
Hey, thanks for having me. And great show last week, Matthew. Really appreciated listening to it. I've worked on my diction. I'll be better. But thank you.
All right. Well, let's see if we can top it. I think this one, based on the pre-show, may be a little bit more contentious and not quite so agreeable between all of us. But before we get into that, I should just mention a somewhat momentous occasion. This is our first episode on AMDG Radio Network. We hope to continue forward with a weekly format under AMDG's banners, and we certainly thank the kind folk at AMDG for taking this show on. And, of course, Swords in Space Radio, you can find us on the web at www.swordsandspace.com. And please consider liking us on Facebook at facebook.com/swordsandspace, and that's where you're going to probably the best place to make sure you're on top of all of our upcoming shows and anything else that's going on. So without further ado, let's get into the film. We discussed the novel last week, one of the all-time great novels, but Stephen, as you're wont to say, you shouldn't really or compare a novel with a film. Because they're two completely different media. You're saying it's like comparing a music to a painting. So maybe let's start out just taking the film on its own without reference to the novel. What do each of you think of the film? We'll start with our guest, Matthew. What did you think of it? Just in brief, and then we'll get into more specifics.
I'm not allowed to compare to the book. Wow. Okay. I liked it in aspects, but because I can't help it, I like the book for what it is. Can't help but referencing back to it. I felt the film was a bit bipolar, so there are parts I liked, parts I could leave. So I would give it it's a good popcorn flick, but I'm not going to get too excited about it. I'll just leave that as my opener.
All right. So, Stephen, what do you say?
Well, you know, he's only seen a third of Peter Jackson's vision, so maybe he can only be a third happy with it. I don't think we can talk about it. Again, I refrain from talking about the book because I don't feel it's a very useful point of discussion, but I think probably to talk about The Hobbit, we would need to talk about our impressions of Lord of the Rings, because even if you listen to our opening music, Howard Shore, I hear strains of Lord of the Rings in there. Yes, there's a slightly more different, more, I don't know, hopeful, innocent prequel strain to it, but it's still Howard Shore and it's still Lord of the Rings, and you can't watch this movie without the baggage of the 17-hour extended super director's editions that were released and everything that comes with that. So I would agree with Matthew. I think it's a good watch. It's certainly not a waste of money. whether in 3D or in 2D. But I feel like success can make someone really indulgent, and how you manage to do 100 pages of text in 2.5 hours blows my mind.
Yeah, well,
180 minutes for 100 pages of text, that's impressive.
Impressive is one word for it, and you pretty much anticipated my comments. I think we're all of a similar thought about having kind of mixed feelings about it, although to me the first word that comes to mind is bloated. I mean, like he really stretched to turn that into 2.5 hours or 3 hours, I don't know. It felt like more. I have to say, frankly, as much as I actually liked Lord of the Rings, and Stephen, I think there was a hint of not liking Lord of the Rings in your commentary. So maybe we should get that out of what each of us thought about Lord of the Rings. I'm one of the few that likes the novels, and I really enjoyed the films, and I have the extended edition that you mentioned, Stephen, and I've watched it and enjoyed it.
Well, I was gonna. I mean, we could turn this sideways and talk about whether you should watch the extended editions of episodes 4, 5, and 6, but then this would turn into a full scale war. So, as far as the original, the Lord of the Rings that we got to watch. So let's pretend for a second people aren't going to watch the extended edition, just the ones that they probably saw in the theaters. I think, in one way. Like Star Wars fans waiting for episodes 1 through 3, the movie was never going to be up to expectations. In other ways, it surpassed our wildest possible imagination. I mean, hearing Elvish spoken, seeing the ridiculous CGI battles, which, you know, would have excited every 14-year-old boy in me that first read The Hobbit and Lord of the Rings.
Ridiculous CGI as in well-done CGI.
Yes, ridiculous. But I would say that, my good friend Nicholas Wansbutter refers to the idea of fantasy fulfillment rather than actual fantasy. And so the challenge here, as in any time I go back to a book that I actually want to read, is now, unfortunately, I have Orlando Bloom in my head when I'm reading about Legolas. Which is maybe not such a problem. Or Viggo Mortensen, as I think Viggo Mortensen is very well cast as Strider. But the point is, when you obsess about a movie that happens to come from a book, it I think somewhat eviscerates the enjoyment you can get from the book. Part relating to what you said earlier, I referenced earlier, Nicholas, about fantasy fulfillment. So you have these huge CGI battles, and yes, it is very accurate, and we see that wave, the riders from Rohan coming in. It's exactly how we might have visualized it in the book, but then again, maybe it's not at all. Mm. And I think part of the challenge of really liking and obsessing about these movies is you are automatically giving up the chance to enjoy the books ever again on your own without reliving it through Peter Jackson's eyes. And with Lord of the Rings, there are a lot of casting choices I really enjoyed, and there are a lot of things to like about the movie. I just think that it's such an epic sweep, and I felt, to the point about the extended editions, I just felt like, when you want to do a screen adaptation of that, is the goal to do a faithful repetition of everything in the book, or try to take a snapshot, like another work of art, and come up with your own vision of what this is trying to do? And, it takes the exact opposite in The Hobbit, where we're, going to make something much longer than it normally was. So I suppose I bring that vision. When I came to The Hobbit, I was already coming with mixed feelings about Lord of the Rings. And I own all the movies, too. I'm not going to pretend that I don't own every movie. I have them all. But because I think it's just sort of required watching for a Tolkien fan, but it doesn't mean that I love them, like I would, let's say, love, episode 5.
Right. Okay, well, that's fair enough. That's not as negative as I thought I was going to hear, because I think we're fairly on the same page here. I mean, I like them. I don't love them. But, Matthew, what are brief thoughts on Lord of the Rings, and then we'll continue on with the Hobbit monstrosity.
You're poisoning the well here. Great cinematography, a great CGI, sweeping epics, the score. I mean, these were things that were just touchstones of the Lord of the Rings movie. I was actually a seminarian when the first one came out, and I had a break, and somebody said, you have to see this, and he actually took me to IMAX before, of course, 3D and IMAX have become, like, you know, everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember that scene where they go into the mines of Moria, and he lets the light, and you just see those massive pillars. That was just epic. And, you know, the camera angles going down the tower after the butterflies visited Gandalf. And the Balrog was, I was so happy to see what they did with that. I mean, it was much bigger than I had ever imagined in my own mind. But the problem with my approach was I'd read the book 7.5 times before I'd seen the movies. And these guys in my head, these characters, they had their own world. They're very, very defined for me. And then the movie just kind of bulldozed over all of that because I'm a very visual person. And, oh, man, Aragorn, I just found effeminate. Gimli, they turn into a Disney sidekick. Legolas, you know, it's just on and on and on. I was unhappy with how they did that, you know?
Okay, so a little strong opinion there. But, see, now here's an interesting thing. I think in both of your commentaries, it begs the question to me of, should works like that even be attempted to be adapted into film because of that mental image and how it can interplay with your enjoyment of the book? And maybe the reason I'm much more forgiving of the films is because I actually saw the Fellowship of the Ring before I had ever read any of the novels. Now, I went and read all three of them right after I'd seen Fellowship of the Ring. And
I'm very surprised to hear that you hadn't read the books.
Yeah, I'm a bit surprised too, because I read everything else fantasy and science fiction growing up. I'm not exactly sure how that happened, but for some reason, Lord of the Rings just never crossed my path growing up. Although I seem to remember seeing a copy of one of the books in my parents' house, so it was there, but they just never, no one I knew had read them, and my parents didn't really recommend them to me for whatever reason. So, but back to the Peter Jackson's film, I mean, monstrosity, I called it. I mean, that's a little bit of hyperbole. But it is bloated. I think it's a... It struck me as a bit of Tom Clancy syndrome, where he's become a victim of his own success. And this is, it's like the Star Wars prequels. He's just throwing in there anything and everything he wants without being edited. And I thought the film really showed how film editors are the unsung heroes of film, because I was frankly, when the end credits came up, I was thinking, thank goodness, I don't think I could have handled more of this. I'm bored. And this is from, you know, me, that, you know, who eats this stuff up. We should talk about, maybe so we don't forget, like we've forgotten the Dread Show, what age of viewing, who should see this, would you say? Is it a kids' movie, adult movie?
It follows the protocol of slicing someone open and there being no blood on your sword. So I don't know how restrictive we need to be with the sword play of with no blood. So I might say PG-13 or mature 10, 11, and 12 year olds, or might maybe hold it out as a reward for, you know, a precocious 10, 11, 12-year-old who's read the book and can tell me why they like it.
Well, this actually gets me onto the bipolar attitude of the film. Like, remember that Golem was killing that orc, and the orc revived, and they gave it two good slams on the stone again? Remember that scene?
Yeah.
That's pretty grisly. And Azog throwing the guy to the dogs, and the farmer, the troll's talking about there how the stringy farmer that they've just eaten, they're getting, picking their teeth with his bones, and I mean, it's pretty grisly stuff. We're talking about Grimm's fairy tale stuff here, but with the visual. It reminded me of that scene in Legend. Have you seen Legend, either of you?
Yes.
Tom Cruise 80s film?
Right.
Yeah? Have you seen that one part they had to edit out where the butcher is literally chopping someone and the body is convulsing? It's like absolutely, it's like a horror movie. And that kind of reminded me when Golem was doing that to the orc. So I don't know. It's a really weird scene. And
yeah, so you'd put it a bit older.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think we've become desensitized to a degree, but at the same time, you don't want to coddle children. So I'm kind of, I don't know. I honestly don't know. I don't have children, so.
Well, I'm the only one on this show that does have children. And I'm a bit with you, Matthew, I would let my children see Lord of the Rings at a younger age than The Hobbit because of some of the things you're pointing out. And I think that, but as I said, it's kind of bipolar because then there's a lot of aspects to it that would seem more targeted towards the younger audience. But I thought the whole way that violence is dealt with in The Hobbit troubling, like the thing where Gandalf, slices clean through a goblin's neck and then kind of looks at him quizzically and then pokes his head off with the staff, or when he eviscerates the goblin king and the goblin king has some, I don't know, say like, oh, that'll do it or something like that, and then he collapses.
Yeah, exactly.
So, I found that I found that disturbing.
Yeah, it's very flippant. It treats violence very flippant, and the characters that are getting slaughtered, like you mentioned, the orcs getting his head slit off, his eyes actually jog back and forth, looking at his shoulders. He knows he's been cut, and then it goes to the back of his head, and they knock his head off. I mean, it treats it very flippantly.
Yeah, and I have a problem with the flippantly. Like, I can handle violence aplenty. I mean, I'm a fan of Apocalypto, which, the liberal media was losing their minds over how violent it is. But the huge difference for that film from this to me is, there's blood and gore and all kinds of stuff all over the place in Apocalypto, but it's done in a way that I felt it's like showing how horrific this stuff is and that this is bad to be doing this sort of thing.
Yeah.
Versus a glorification of violence.
Yeah. And we're meant to laugh at The Hobbit, yeah. Exactly.
Yeah.
So, I don't know. As a parent, you'd have to call that. For myself, I really don't know. Children these days, they see so much, I don't know. Yeah.
Well, and every parent has to make their own call, I think, and we don't have things like the Legion of Decency or, I don't know. You don't really...
Have your show.
Right. So now, what did the two of you think of this fancy schmancy high film or high frame rate or whatever this frame rate? I'm the sci-fi guy who's also a Luddite, so I can't even remember what the terminology is. But I just remember it advertises the frame rate that is supposed to look like real life, or it's the same frame rate that our eyes work at.
48 frames per second. That's right, twice as fast as a normal film.
I watch a lot of IMAX and I watch a lot of 3D, and I feel in the Brave New World sense that's just sort of what I expect now. So I guess I wasn't that impressed. I think nothing's ever gonna top how we felt when we watched The Matrix, when we watched Bullet Time for the first time, and how that changed that sort of genre's cinematography. I can't think of anything really impressing as much now. I think individual scenes, like Matthew was referring to the Balrog and the pillars there, I think individual scenes can impress, but I think we just have such a high level of expectation now for what a movie is going to deliver. I don't know, because I didn't see it in 2D. I will see movies in 3D or in IMAX if they are available. If it says it's in IMAX, I'm going to see it in IMAX. That's just how it is.
See, to me, I thought it looked fake. Like I thought it looked like it was. It seemed like it was almost slightly in fast forward. I guess it was, because it's filmed at a higher frame rate. But to me, it looked almost like a British sitcom. Like, you know how it doesn't quite look right? I don't know. Neither of you found that.
I had your experience for about the first 5 minutes, and then I adjusted, and I'm beginning to wonder whether or not that's because of my misspent youth playing video games. I've heard they're at a higher, not frame rate, but a refresh rate. I think I was already acclimated to it, but I don't know if that's true or not. Somebody said that some of these refresh rates are up to 125 frames per second, or refresh rate, and I don't know if that's true.
Hmm.
But I remember adapting within 5 minutes. But yeah, at the first part, it was literally like my eyes and my ears were not syncing. It was very bizarre.
Hmm. Yeah, I got a little bit used to it, but I still would find I'd notice it here and there. But Howard Shore's score, Stephen brought it up earlier. I mean, again, I thought that was one of the best parts of the film, and one of the best parts of the Lord of the Rings films was the score. And I especially loved the music that they put to the Dwarves Misty Mountains song. I mean, I've heard a few different versions of that song on different audio books, but I really, really liked how they did that.
Yeah, Howard Shore is amazing. He did a really, I mean, they're touchstone. Those sounds. It's what is like Jaws, for instance, or E.T. They're going to be classics forever.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's very evocative. Absolutely.
So, for anyone who's just joining us, you're listening to Swords and Space Radio, and today our topic is the Hobbit film. And we're joined today by our guest is Matthew Zepp, the editor-in-chief of Brev's Index. I'll try and pump that up a bit for you. I hope you got some hits on the website last week, and that's www.bravsindex.com. And, of course, Swords in Space is swordsinspace.com. So, moving right along, I'll unleash you now and let you talk about comparisons, because I think that's what Matthew was wanting. I felt like I was holding you back there, Matthew, when I was asking for your initial thoughts. And we talked about it a little bit in the show, last week's show. We talked a bit about the dwarves and how they're portrayed differently in the novel and in the film. And just for anyone who hasn't heard last week's episode, maybe you could recap a little bit of what your thoughts were on that.
Oh, so I'm going back to the book then?
Yeah, we're the book.
Okay,
the dwarves,
going back to the book.
The dwarves,
yeah.
How do they compare between the way they're portrayed in the book and the way they're portrayed in the film?
Well, I have to give deference to Stephen's point that you can't really compare the movie with the book. Instinctively, it's hard for me to do that. I come at The Hobbit with an Anglo-Saxon background in the sense of having studied it. And the book is just fantastic when you view that. And I didn't get to see everything just because it didn't come to mind. But I have a blog post for those that look for those parallels or be interested in historical links between the Anglo-Saxon myths and realities and what got put in The Hobbit. But on its own merits, the film, well, I don't see anything Anglo-Saxon in it, although the craftsmanship, once again, Peter Jackson went over the top for all these custom costumes and weapons and decor. And that's not CGI. The Hobbit Hole, for instance, I mean, every single item, custom made, fantastic. But, yeah, this bipolar thing, we talked about the violence and comedy. The golem, for instance, right after he's, you know, manhandled this orc, he plays all cutesy curious with the hobbit. You'd think he would have just jumped him and pummeled him after he just literally slaughtered a living being. He's just all of a sudden playful and wants to play the riddle game. It just kind of ground, you know. And it was like that the whole film for me. The Saruman was an idiot, in my opinion. You remember that scene, the council scene?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, he doesn't believe anything, and then the sword gets thrown on the table, and he's bumbling, and he's denying it. He's a very weak character. I wanted him to come across as stronger or noble, but just comes across as inept. And Galadriel, I've always found her crazy. I don't know about you guys. She's like an ice queen. Oh, wow. Those eyes and that little secret smile. Yeah, I have a lot of trouble loving the characters. I love the universe. I love the visuals, the score, but the characters just, I can't get over them. And the trolls, again, not threatening. The orcs, not threatening. The orcs in the Lord of the Rings, those guys are scary.
Yeah.
But these are just...
Well, in this one, yeah, I mean, like, the thing I was thinking, like, why are the orcs all naked? I mean, like...
I didn't even notice that.
But it's not even consistent within the way that Peter Jackson portrays it, because they're wearing clothes and armor in the Lord of the Rings films. But
well, maybe they decided to wear clothes later on in the storyline.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it just seems a pointless thing, and it's clear in the book that they're wearing armor. I mean, it actually says, like, when Bilbo is approaching the back door, that there's the room's full of goblins all in armor. But
we
just...
the fact that the, sorry.
No, go ahead.
They're like tunnel dwellers, and I mean they're underground, so they're all pale and pasty in complexion, and perhaps armor's not really an issue when you're doing that. I don't know. It's not my film.
Yeah, but one thing we talked about last time is how the dwarves are rather larger than life in the film.
Yeah.
They're a little more tame in the novel. Stephen, what did you think of the portrayal of the dwarves in the film?
And again, to kind of take off on Matthew's point, let me expand on why I don't like comparing the book to the movie. Is I really feel that for most people, this is as close to the book as they're ever going to get. There's a certain segment of the population that is inspired by the movie and will go and read, but I compare it to the comic books. I mean, there are tons of people who love the Iron Man movies who've never touched an Iron Man comic. And comics are much less of a commitment than a book. A comic's a 30-page, 10-minute read that will cost you a couple bucks as opposed to, you know, a 300 or 400-page novel. So there's part of the expansion of this universe, part of the reason comic book movies are doing so well, and part of the reason Lord of the Rings movies, Harry Potter, I hate putting all of these together, but the reason why they're so popular is because it brings the richness of these novels into these people's lives in a limited way. And so when I look at the movie version, what I'm looking for is a responsible snapshot of the book, because you're not going to be able to capture the book. The book's its own thing. They're not comparable. You're talking about using different senses versus, you know, using your imagination. I think they're very badly compared. I mean, the best you can talk about is continuity, or in what you're talking about now is trying to talk about how they're portrayed. I think maybe my favorite scene with dwarves, which might be telling, is their invasion of Bilbo's house. I feel like that is very typical. I felt that whole, both the mirth with which they finish that visit and the rambunctiousness with which they begin it, I liked. I was a bit split on Thorin Oakenshield. I thought that, I went back and read the book again in preparation for the show, I'm not certain how I feel about his portrayal. I guess I wouldn't say it wasn't a memorable portrayal, as I would say Gandalf's portrayal, the Ian McClellan's portrayal of Gandalf was the memorable, Thorin Oakenshield that, you know, I can't say, well, it couldn't have been anyone else. Well, maybe it could have been. So as far as the dwarves go, I think it was a pretty good depiction of what the book is conveying about the dwarves.
Hmm. See, I found them a bit over the top myself. I mean, they individualized them a bit more, which is kind of good, but they were just, you know, they were over the top. Like, they were, to the point of cartoonish, I thought. And you know, the scene you're talking about where they're throwing the plates all over the house, like, it's just kind of, I don't know, I lost my ability to suspend disbelief, because no one's going to be throwing around plates like that without breaking any. Like, it just, it seemed like it's getting cartoonish.
Well, there is a bit of fantasy here, Nicholas.
Well, I know a bit of fantasy, but I think you can do fantastic without cartoonish. I think, and maybe you're the comic book guy, I don't know, but I think you can have serious fantasy, or, I mean, it's that ability to suspend disbelief. I mean, if they had magic or something, then, okay, this is, you know, some magic at play.
And what about when they do that 100-yard end run through the tunnels? They're, like, invincible. They're being charged by goblins on all sides. That was pretty crazy, too. I wouldn't call it cartoonish,
like,
but it was definitely...
They used that star from Super Mario Brothers, and they were invincible for, like, 30 seconds.
Good
so
comparison, yeah.
They were just running through everybody.
But I suppose that's a bit of a hallmark of Peter Jackson, because there were elements of what I'm talking about in the Lord of the Rings films, but I think he just took it up a notch here. I mean, the Lord of the Rings films, I mean, you know, Legolas was, you know, pretty over the top with his arrow work and, you know, using a shield as a snowboard down the stairs. And, but, you know, some of that was to the point of starting to get a little bit goofy. So I guess that's just a Peter Jackson thing. But, I think I think it can be well done. I'm thinking of other fantasy films where you've got people who are, like trying to think of someone who's a fantastic and deadly swordsman. I mean, first who comes to my mind is Mad Mardigan from Willow.
Willow, yeah. I was actually thinking of that, too.
Willow.
He's kind of a comic character, but he doesn't do anything, you know, like, you know, flipping off over up walls or anything weird like that. He actually falls down when he tries, you know, throwing the sword in the air and catching it.
Yeah. And I guess the most epic thing he does is the catapult onto the double-headed beastie in the moat.
Yeah.
That's about it.
But, well, the central character in The Hobbit, obviously, is Bilbo Baggins. What did the two of you think of him in the film?
Well, I'm a Martin Freeman fan. I loved his work in Sherlock. He does an excellent Dr. Watson in Sherlock on the BBC. So I've liked him in that. I've liked him in some other things as well. So I thought he was good. I think he struck just the right note for Bilbo. That sort of, I'm satisfied, I've got a great life, and I thought throughout he was able to show us that transformation, and I think it probably peaks with his speech at the end, you know, well, a couple places, but I would say his speech to the dwarves about why he wants to help them in relation to, you know, where he is in his home. I think that was very well done. So, I like Martin Freeman quite a bit.
Matthew, what do you think? Because we've got this in context of you saying that you think Viggo Mortensen is too effeminate to be Aragorn, and so what did you think of
wasn't it Viggo Mortensen is too effeminate? I thought the way he played the character was too effeminate. Which I just want to make that very, very clear in case he's listening, just in case. The Martin Freeman actor, I have no experience with whatsoever, so I don't know anything he's been in. I didn't know what to expect. I've been tainted by the book, if I might say. I was expecting someone a little plumper, a little more filled out, you know. And he kind of came across as, I don't know. Well, grocery clerk wasn't bad. I like that line. I actually, you know, remember when the dwarves call him, looks like a grocery clerk, not a burglar. That was pretty spot on for me. I found his development a bit too fast. By the end of the film, when he charges single-handedly the entire orc line there that are holding them into the flame, while they're pinned against the pines or in the pines, and then he charges single-handedly. I found that a bit much to swallow for that amount of development, but hey, I bought it.
Yeah.
I thought you did a good job.
Yeah, I really liked his portrayal, but I agree with you. I thought the development of the character was rushed, which is an ironic thing to say when we're talking about a bloated 3-hour film.
Yeah.
But at the same time, that film only covers 100 pages of action in the novel, and so, I mean, that's like, when I say it's bloated, like my point is that nothing happens to justify 3 hours of film, like that, and that's why it's a rushed development. Like, if all kinds of stuff happened in the 3 hours, then you can say, well, yeah, I mean, there's plenty of films that are shorter than that where you have the full character development and it's believable. But here, not enough has happened. They haven't gotten far enough in the journey for that level of development to make sense.
I would argue, though, that, and I can't believe I'm defending it, but I would argue that they're trying to, first of all, the Hobbit is not an epic. I would advance that. You don't have to agree with that premise, but I would say that he was trying to make it into an epic, which is why he put all those, some people say it's in the appendices, some say that, you know, Peter Jackson padded it. But he's setting everything up, the necromancer line, he's setting up the Azog line, he's setting up this line, he's setting up that line, so he's doing all the setup in this first film, and I think it's going to give him the freedom to be pretty crazy in the next two or three to tie these all up or tie them together. So I wouldn't say it was bloated for its own sake. I think he's got a method to his madness here. We just haven't seen it.
No? Well, I think there's a method. But, Stephen, what do you think? Do you think the character development was rushed?
Yes. I mean, it was. But, again, that's the issue is that, you know, what are you going to do within this time frame? And if I'm only looking to capture a snapshot of the book, which is, you know, the best that a movie can do, then yes, I think, you know, I hesitate because I feel like anyone who is listening to this show who did not listen to the last show, I would tell you maybe hit pause on this podcast, go back and listen to Nicholas and Matthew's discussion last week, because I don't want to duplicate some of the great stuff that you guys were talking about, which is the themes that are going on here. And did he do a good job of capturing the themes? The journey, hope, friendship, comradeship, fighting together for a common cause, bravery. And for me, the single most important scene in this version is the sparing of Gollum by Bilbo.
Mm-hmm.
All of those things were captured. So if the purpose is give people who are never going to read The Hobbit a good snapshot of the beauty and grace of the book, yeah. In that it does a serviceable job in those ways. And that's why, like I said, I have mixed feelings. But, you know, if you don't have a super high standard, and if you're approaching it from the person who doesn't even know who J.R.R. Tolkien is, although that's pretty much impossible after the Lord of the Rings movies, I think it does a decent job.
And I don't dispute that, but I'm just saying, like, in and of itself, I think there's a problem when Bilbo goes from, you know, more a grocer than a burglar all the way to going toe-to-toe with Azog or whatever his name is. Like, well, how are they going to develop him in the other two films? Because in the book, he doesn't start becoming, you know, it's more gradual, and, you know, he starts getting a bit tougher when he kills a spider on his own in the woods, and then kind of, you know, facing down the dragon and that. So, you know, he's still got progression to make. Like, I mean, if he's already, you know, challenging, you know, Azog the Despoiler, or whatever his name was, to single combat to protect Thorin by the end of this film, I'm worried he's going to be doing Legolas and Gimli-ish feats, like flipping around in the Battle of the Five Armies, eviscerating goblins or something.
Well, that's true. I wonder how they will handle that. Because, yeah, he didn't even participate. Well, that would be interesting to see. Well, okay.
But don't you think, like, he's come so far, like, how much further is he going to go? Or you think I'm off base on that?
I think you exaggerate a bit, but, yeah, he's gotten to the point where he's going toe-to-toe with anyone. So, yeah, how do you top that? That's interesting. Don't know.
Stephen, what do you think? Or is your silence proof of the fact that my oratory skills have rendered you dumb and unable to respond?
I'm just in awe. I don't know what to say.
Take that compliment and run, Nicholas. You gotta run when you can.
Yeah. All right. So, anything else that either of you would want to bring up that we haven't covered? Well, we've probably got about 5 minutes left before we should move on to the Event Horizon segment of the show. Mm-hmm. Matthew?
Kind of said my things. I really emphasize for those that haven't seen the film, the eagle scene alone is very visually stunning, very enjoyable. For that alone, I would say watch it. Otherwise, I'll go down saying that it's a good film to watch. Not totally sold on it being The Hobbit. Actually, I have a question actually for you guys. You were saying at the beginning, I wanted to say this, I didn't say it. Should we be making books like this into film? And I think, how can you resist when we have the technology now? But it's different from theater, because in theater, for instance, you can have, you know, Richard III or Othello 1,000 times, always be a different production. And, you know, people, they'll talk about which one was good or which one was bad, but no one gets too heated about it. In movies, you don't have that. I think it's because the direction. In theater, you don't have the direction written right into the script. People can't really say, oh, that's not how I imagined Iago. They can kind of appreciate the interpretation, whereas in film, we're much more critical. And I think it's because the direction is given. Is that fair? Do you guys think that's fair?
Stephen, what do you think?
I think that these works provide such a rich source of material. They're going to get made. I think they're kind of shoehorn in something that we missed that I wanted to talk about along these lines is the 1978 animated Lord of the Rings movie, and that
okay, yeah.
I think an animated version. I'm very, very worried that we'll become fossilized and say, well, you know, Lord of the Rings, there's that one. You know, well, I'd love to see an animated version. You know, we've got the technology to do something a bit more like that. Not, you know, in the Pixar kiddie way, but to do something really cutting edge like 300, the movie adaptation. So I hope that people don't feel intimidated into thinking this is it. So I'm even open to seeing another Lord of the Rings. But I suppose that's like some people saying, you know, you should remake Star Wars. But that's what I consider episodes 1 through 3 anyway.
Although look at the success they've had with the remake of Star Trek.
Yes, that's true.
You know, and they've been able to pull that off. You know, recasting Captain Kirk, who's such a William Shatner. You know, it's...
Yeah, but come on. The original movies are laughable by today's standards. You know, see what I mean? I don't know if you agree with that, but I mean, they're pretty hokey.
I think Star Trek II, The Wrath of Khan, is one of the greatest science fiction movies ever.
Oh, do you? Okay, I'll back off then. Okay.
Some of the other ones are definitely hokey, but Star Trek II, definitely one of the best Trek movies ever, but... Just, I would put them up there.
Just
one of the science fiction movies ever.
Yeah.
Well, I'm just in Rage of the Trekkies, Nicholas. You got to save me here.
Yeah. Well, I'm not really a Trekkie, but we will.
Well, we forgive you.
Yeah. Well.
I see torches out my window. We got to wrap this up.
Yeah. Well. In answer to your question, I think I asked the same question earlier, and I'm not really sure what the answer is of whether books like Lord of the Rings should be made into a film. I guess it's the danger of doing that adaptation, and I think, you know, the same complaints that we've heard here about characters their portrayal in the film not being the way people envisioned them or not being in keeping, that's always going to be a problem. And that's one of the beauties of novels versus films, is that with a novel, each reader can have their own take, and it's kind of like theater in the mind, where you're saying, Matthew, that, you know, you can have all kinds of different productions, so it's kind of like each, you know, there's different productions within people's minds of each film. That's one of the great things about novels, and one of the, you know, that's maybe a downside of filmmaking reaching the heights that it has, is maybe that, you know, are people even going to bother reading as much? I mean, we already know that people aren't reading as much, but although I would encourage people to read The Hobbit, as we did last week. And I should just, before we move on to the next segment, I've been coming across as fairly negative about the film. I don't think I'm as negative. I didn't dislike it as much as I've perhaps given the impression. I'm just trying to maybe be a little bit of devil's advocate. But, I guess I'm kind of middle-of-the-road feelings about it. It's not something that I love, 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 but I enjoyed it enough. I think if I buy it and rip it onto my iMac and do my own editing job with iMovie, I think I'll enjoy it much more, because I'd pare it down to about about an hour and a half film.
Well, like I said, we have to see what he's going to do in these next films, because all of this extra stuff, well, maybe we could cut off a little bit of the troll scene, a little bit of the intro scene, but I think a lot of it's going to come back. I'm giving the benefit of the doubt, but we'll see.
I think it will come back, because a lot of stuff that was in the novel mentioned but unseen is going to be seen here, like that whole necromancer storyline. All you hear about it in the novel is Gandalf explaining that the reason he disappeared during part of their quest and where he'd been all that time was he'd gotten together with the other wizards to go and defeat the necromancer. So I'm pretty sure we're going to see that showdown in the next films.
Yeah. Well, there's another point. I didn't realize how much Deus Ex Machina is in The Hobbit until watching the film. Did you notice that too? Every time they're in trouble, how the wizard Gandalf pops up and saves the day.
Yeah.
You know?
I'd kind
it
of
disturbed me.
That.
It didn't disturb me in the book.
Yeah, I don't know. It didn't disturb me, but I'd noticed it in the book, and I kind of, as a writer, thought bitterly to myself, "Well, I'm not allowed to do that. I could never get away with that." But, you know, Tolkien gets to do this stuff. But I guess if you have his mastery of language and his skill, then you can get away with that.
Maybe that's why. I was very blind to it until the film, and I realized that's not Jackson, that's Tolkien. But anyway.
Stephen, do you have any comment on that before we move on?
No.
You're still stunned to silence by my rhetoric?
Well, you know, we are in your presence, counselor. I would go along your lines, Nicholas. If you were to put together, and I think there are so many wonderful movies out, you know, I don't know that this would, if I put together a fantasy list and you made me pick a top 10, I don't know that this would make that list. It might be supplemental viewing. I think the Lord of the Rings movies are on that list. I find sometimes people get really, really excited and, oh, this is the best. And I think they're just so starved for other means of entertainment or culture in their life. So, you know, they got to seize on it, like, well, The Hobbit's really so awesome. Like, well, you know, the book's really great, and there are other things that are really great. Yes, there are bits of it that I really love. I love the Howard Shore music. I own the soundtrack from Last Ones and love that. I love certain scenes, but I'm just not enamored of it. You know, if on a scale of 1 to 10, I'd give it a solid 7.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that sounds about right. So, anyone that's just joining us, you're listening to Swords in Space Radio. We have been discussing The Hobbit, Part the First by Peter Jackson, the film adaptation. We've just wrapped up our discussion of that, but of course the podcast will be available for listening about 5 to 10 minutes after we end broadcast tonight. I'm your host, Nicholas Wansbutter, joined by my co-host, Stephen Heiner, and we have our guest, Matthew Zepp of Bravs Index with us. So onto the Event Horizon episode of the show, or portion of the show. And so, Stephen, maybe I'll turn it over to you.
Do I have a treat for you, kids. The movie summer, as we are now in the golden age of comic book movies, promises a good one. We don't have the Avengers this summer. We don't have Dark Knight Rises, but we do have some promising new beginnings. I would start by the re-release, the 20-year re-release of Jurassic Park in 3D and IMAX. I haven't seen that yet. I remember I loved the book. I anticipated the movie, but we just didn't have that kind of technology. So I'd love to see it recast, because I thought it was a cutting-edge movie in its time. So I would love to see that on a huge 10-story IMAX screen. So I'm going to try to see that. For people who have missed that, that got re-released on April the 5th. This Friday, a movie I'm looking forward to, Nicholas, not so much, Tom Cruise's Oblivion, in a post-apocalyptic world, with Morgan Freeman as the Eminence Grease, which I think that's just required. Morgan Freeman is supposed to play the wise old man in every movie. But I'm looking forward to that. Nicholas, you're not looking forward to that. Matthew, wonder where you are on that.
I really don't know what to say. There's a lot of, as you mentioned, post-apocalyptic movies come out after Earth with the two, Jaden and Will Smith. Elysium. Have you heard of this one yet, Elysium? Matt Damon?
Yeah, I've heard of it.
Yeah, I just saw the preview, the trailer for it for the first time today.
Yeah, so there's quite a rash of post-apocalyptic sci-fi coming out, which is good. I'm glad to see sci-fi is marketable. It always seems to be a risk. You know, sci-fi films usually bomb or they're accepted quite well. Oblivion, Tom Cruise. I have a problem with Tom Cruise. I love him as a bad guy, but the problem is he never plays a bad guy. So he's in Collateral, for instance.
Yeah, Collateral.
And in The Last Samurai.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, in The Last Samurai, he's kind of a drunk bum that kind of, I can relate with him, but usually when he's the hero, I find myself shaking my head. So I would like to see it, but because it's Tom Cruise, I probably won't see it in theaters.
Well,
I don't know what to say about that. Otherwise,
I couldn't disagree more.
Well, what about it has you so excited, Stephen?
I like the special effects, but I am unabashedly a Tom Cruise fan. I have no problem saying that. And the Mission Impossible 4 movie he did was just fantastic. So I like what he does. And keep in mind, I think sometimes for some actors, you know, people say Tom Cruise is the same actor in every movie, Robert De Niro is the same actor in every movie. Well, I happen to like Robert De Niro playing Robert De Niro or Tom Cruise playing Tom Cruise. So I like it. There are plenty of haters, so I obviously understand Matthew's position. I just like the special effects. I think I like the storyline. And I like that. And I'm going to be let down if it does what In Time did to me, which, you know, In Time teased me with an idea for, you know, a really great story, and then it let me down. So they might do this here, too, because I think Oblivion has managed to obscure, you know, what's really going on quite well. So if they manage to pull off something excellent, I'd be very happy. But I'm prepared to be disappointed in that.
He's a trooper. Again, he's a trooper.
Moving on to May, we've got Iron Man 3 and Star Trek Into Darkness both coming out that month. Couldn't possibly be more excited about either of these movies. There's been a 4-issue comic prequel put out by IDW for this that helps to set up the storyline, which I think is excellent. And Iron Man 3, bringing in the Mandarin, and Ben, the Mandarin, which is maybe Tony Stark's biggest arch enemy in the Iron Man books. But Ben Kingsley as the Mandarin is just inspired. And I'm really looking forward. I'm really looking forward to Gandhi versus Robert Downey Jr.
I wasn't going to say it, but you got it. Yeah, okay.
And then moving on, in June, we have After Earth that comes out at the beginning of June, June 7th. But then we also have Man of Steel, which promises to be questionable. I think we're all very excited because it's a Superman movie. But if this movie doesn't go, the Justice League movie for DC is effectively dead. So I think that outside of the fanboy universe, most people don't know. If this movie doesn't go or take off, if I can pun it a little bit, the Justice League movie for DC will die on arrival. They can't make a Justice League movie unless they make a Superman movie stick, and the last one didn't. So we'll see how this goes. I have a lot of confidence in Zack Snyder. He did Watchmen, and he did 300. So I'm looking forward to see what he can do here. In July, we've got Pacific Rim, which is, I suppose, is that another post-apocalyptic?
Godzilla-type movie, isn't it?
Yeah, something like that. We've got that in July, and we also have The Wolverine, the most popular ongoing character from the X-Men franchise, in another movie. And then towards the end of the summer, we have 300, another sort of the naval version of 300. And then at the end, the very end of summer, around Labor Day weekend, we're going to have Riddick, which I am very excited about.
Yeah. Now, out of all those you listed, that's the one I'm kind of looking forward to. But I once bitten, twice shy, and I got bitten big time on Prometheus. So I'm very shy of anything at the theaters now. And for listeners, you'll want to tune in next week because we're going to have a battle royal about Prometheus. I'm going to vent my spleen with my rage over how horrible that film was. And I anticipate I may get some pushback on that from Brian Pauls, who will be returning as a guest on that show. And we'll have Stephen as a referee between the two of us.
To answer that question, which of those you're most excited about, Riddick, Matthew, or are you most excited about any of those?
I do like the Riddick. I like the dark, creepy sci-fi. I like that kind of feel. Riddick definitely has that kind of feel. But I'm one of those people that kind of waits for everyone else to tell me what's good, and then I might go to the theater. I'm not much of a comic fan. In fact, my whole book, Revelatio, is kind of trying to debunk the myth, and I realize that that's not a popular thing to do, but I would say I'd wait. I'm not going to jump onto anything until I hear some good reviews. So I'll be listening to your show, guys.
Tune into our show because we're going to discuss Star Trek Into Darkness. I mean, I hadn't seen the trailer until this afternoon, I realized, hey, I've never even seen the trailer for that. Having seen the trailer, Stephen, I've got to say I'm getting a little bit excited after seeing that trailer.
Well, that's good. I think it's going to be a great movie. Benedict Cumberbatch, The Other Side of Sherlock, with Martin Freeman, our Hobbit, I think is going to be an excellent villain. I love everything that J.J. Abrams has done with that, which, you know, ties back to a previous Event Horizon discussion about what he's going to do for Star Wars. So we'll see what he continues to do for Star Trek here.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, thank you, gentlemen, both of you, for another very interesting and geek-tastic discussion. You've been listening to Swords in Space Radio. Our topic today was the first of the Hobbit films by Peter Jackson. Our guest was Matthew Zepp, and we're very grateful to have him with us. And Matthew, just a reminder to our listeners, is the editor-in-chief of Bravs Index, and that you can find that at www.bravsindex.com. And I encourage listeners to check that out. It's got lots of great free science fiction and fantasy for your reading pleasure, and they're coming out with new free stuff all the time. And I've been Nicholas Wansbutter, your host, along with Stephen Heiner, and Swords in Space Radio. You can check out our website as well, www.swordsandspace.com, and like us on Facebook, facebook.com/swordsandspace. And that'll keep you up to date on all the future shows we have coming up. But please join us next week for what promises to be a lively and interesting discussion of the film Prometheus. And we will leave you with more of Howard Shore's excellent music from The Hobbit. And thanks again, Steve and Matthew, for joining me.
Thank you.
Thank you for having me.